Morning. Today's daf in Gittin is Nun Aleph. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. As long as Yechon Nishmas Lib, Begar Be'el Bashmuel. We begin the Gemara today on daf Nun Amud Beis. We are starting at the two dots towards the top of the Amud. In the middle of the fifth parak of the Masechta, towards the beginning of the fifth parak of the Masechta. So we're still back on the Mishnah, and the Mishnah taught us just a short couple days ago on Memchas Amud Beis, the basic concept regarding the structure of payments, of repayments in terms of an obligation. If the obligation is Nezik, so you pay back with Idus, with the best property. If it's a Bachov, it's a regular obligation. So you pay back with Beinonis, and if it's Ksuvas Isha, so Machlokas, but the Halach is, You pay Ksuvas Isha with Zibaris. So what we've been discussing since the Mishnah has been various aspects of this of these types of structured payments. The Mishnah then went on to discuss that there are other cases where a Baal Chov is only going to be collecting from Zibaris, not from Beinonis. Meaning, the Baal Chov principally should be collecting from Beinonis. The reason being is because we want to strike a balance between not over-incentivizing the lender, but also at the same time getting the lender at least to give him some incentive in order to lend. Right? If the Baal Chov were to be paid back with Idus, so then that would basically instigate predatory lending, because you know you're going to get paid back with Idus, and you're going to lend money, and you're going to find some sort of poor individual who's really cash poor but land rich, and what an excellent opportunity to lend the money, and you know he's going to default, and you're just going to take the land away. So that's really going to entice lenders to lend, and in doing so in a very in a way that would injure other people. So that's why not. It is at the same time, if you have the Baal Chov collecting Ziboris, so then who's going to want to lend money? You're going to lend money, and you know meanwhile that the loan is only going to be secured by inferior grade property. So who's going to want to lend money? So the balance is that the Baal Chov is going to get paid back with Beinonis. That's basically the approach the Gemara has taken for the past couple of days. But going back to the Mishnah points out that there are going to be times and occasions where the Baal Chov, the creditor, is going to get paid back with Ziboris. One example the Mishnah said is the Yesomim, when we're talking about orphans. So orphans are only going to get paid back with, when they have to pay back a debt, they're going to only have to pay back with Ziboris. And again, that's for the interest of protecting the orphans. And then the Mishnah went on to discuss, I went out of order. Okay, I felt something was wrong. Okay, same basic point. Just I'm going back one line in the Mishnah. Okay, and another time where the creditor is only going to get Ziboris is the following. Let's say that he is a creditor and the borrower has an outstanding debt against him, and now he's going to the bar and he says, okay, it's time to pay up. And the borrower says, look, I'm really sorry, I don't have any money. So he says, okay, I have a lien against your property. So now, let's say he had a number of properties at the time of the origination of the loan, but he sold off most of his properties, and he sold off all the Beinonis, and all he's got left by him now is Ziboris. So the options are to go chase down the lien holder is now going to chase down either the Beinonis property, which was already sold off, or the Ziboris property, which is on hand. So the Mishnah says, given that those are the two options, the creditor can only go after the Ziboris property, which is on hand, and not go after the Beinonis property that was sold off. That's another occasion where the Baal Chov is only going to get paid Beinonis. I'm sorry, Ziboris and not Beinonis. Okay, that's what we learned back in the Mishnah. With that stated, we are now on Nun Amud Beis. We're towards the top of the Amud. Ein Efrayim Nechas Meshabad Memakam Sheish Bnei Chorin. By Rav Achtuboy Ba'amim Bematana Hech. What if the borrower did not sell the properties, but he gifted the properties away? Meaning, intuitively, what do we all understand? That really, we're doing all this to protect the buyer. Meaning, the buyer. Let's talk from his perspective for just a moment. The buyer wants to know that when he buys a property, no one's going to take the property away from him. Now, yes, the seller who sold it has outstanding debts, but you know what? He has outstanding debts, but he also has other properties. I know when I buy this property, even though there's a lien against the seller, but I also know that the seller has other properties. So let the lien holder go after the other properties, not the one that I just bought. So in other words, basically, we are interested in protecting the buyer's property. That understood. But the Gemara says, I wonder, I wonder now, are we also interested in protecting not just the buyers of property, but let's say the recipient of a gift? Let's say that instead of selling the property, he gifts the property away. Are we also interested in protecting the recipient of a gift so that nobody now can come along and take that property away from him? Meaning you have a lien holder, and the lien holder now wants the satisfaction of his loan. So now he's going to go after the principal borrower. Principal borrower doesn't have any money. Oh, but he gifted some properties away. Are we going to also protect the recipient of the gift? One can easily envision. On one hand, we're interested in protecting the buyer because he paid for the property. That's money out of his pocket. But the recipient of a gift, what did he do to receive it? Nothing, meaning he didn't give any money away. So maybe we're only interested in protecting the buyer of the property, but not necessarily the recipient of the gift. That's exactly the Gemara's question. The Gemara wants to know, to what extent are we ready to protect the beneficiary of the property? Is it only the case of a sale, or would it also include the case of a gift as well? The Gemara articulates the question, Takantuhu David Rabbana Mishum Pseda Delukuchos. Is it just to protect the people who have actually purchased the property? So Matana Deleka Pseda Delukuchos Lo, and the recipient of a gift, obviously he didn't pay for the property. O Dilma Matana Nami Or the Gemara says, look, we all know, even though you're receiving a gift, there's really no such thing as a gift. Meaning, what is a gift? A gift is it's a return of favor. It's a reciprocity. Now, even though right now I'm not commanding any type of money for this property I'm giving you, but we all understand, either in the future or in the past, there must have been some sort of reciprocity. There must have been some sort of favor that was returned in exchange for the gift. There's no such thing as just a isolated gift. And so one can then articulate and suggest that maybe this institution to protect the buyer is also going to protect the gift, the recipient of gift as well. Because he's not just getting a gift. There must have been something done in return for that gift that he received. V'hilkach ki pseda delukuchos dami. And so therefore, this is analogous to pseda delukuchos, and therefore we're interested in protecting him as well. Okay, so the question is pretty straightforward. When we say that we're protecting the buyer of property, are we also looking to protect the recipient of a gift? And again, when we say protection, we mean that in the event that the lien holder is coming to get his obligation paid, and the only thing that the borrower has on hand is the boris, can he go after the beinonis properties that were sold off? So if they were sold off, the answer is unequivocally no. Because the buyer can say, don't come after me, I know I left properties by the borrower, so you don't come after me. But what about in the case of a recipient of a gift? Can he also ward off the lien holder? That's the question the Gemara now is going to discuss. The Gemara's assumption is that a gift is not just a pure act of tzedakah. The Gemara's assumption is that the gift must be some sort of return of favor. I mean, the Gemara says it. So
what about the gift that's
that just purely tzedakah?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not unsure, yeah. But the Gemara right now is talking in terms of matana. So the Gemara says, "Amalei Makashisha Breid Rav Chisal Rav Ashi Tashmashchem Mirasha Matenu Masayim Zelaploni VeGimel Meos Laploni Rav Vidal Meos Laploni Ein Omrim." So let's say a person is about to die and is giving away his properties, and he says, "I want you to give 200 to so and so, 300 to so and so, 400 to so and so." So basically, he structures the giving away of his properties where it's, he wants basically all of his properties to be given away. It's just a question of who's going to get how much. He'll get $200 worth, $300 worth, $400 worth. So, Ein Omrim Kol HaKodim B'Shar Zacha. Now here, there is no order. Meaning, yes, he did articulate $200, $300, and then $400 worth of property. But the truth of the matter is that he only said that because you physically cannot say all these things at the same time. Can get away with saying two things at the same time. But we can't. So, but over here, just because he said it sequentially doesn't mean that there's a particular order. Therefore, if there is a lien holder, if there's a note holder against the properties, so what that note holder now is entitled to do is to take basically whichever properties he wants. What about the recipient of these lands? So what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to redistribute. Meaning that, again, there's no order. And because there's no order, the lien holder can go after any one of the properties. And then, after the property's been taken away, after the lien holder's been satisfied, then and only then, there'll just simply be a redistribution. Fine.
But there's no property. There was money here.
The money over here just is simply a value of property.
I see.
Right. It's not. I know that was confusing. But it meant property. However, if it was very clear from the person who was dying, he, by inserting the word acharav, that he wanted the sequence to be significant. First him, then him, then him. So first 200, then 300, then 400. Now, omrim kolakon b'shtar zacha. So now there's an order in terms of who's the recipient of the properties. And now that there's an order of who's the recipient, so now last one in, it's last, I should say, sorry, last recipient, so he's really standing, he's really holding the bet, left holding the bag. Or in this case, holding the property. Meaning that now if there's a lien holder that's coming, so the first one who received said, wait 1 second, don't come to me. In other words, when I received my property, there were still other properties in the estate on hand. So don't you dare come after me. Same with the second. It's only the third person now who's going to be with the last freestanding property. Now it's no longer freestanding. He received it, but at the time when he received it, there was no other properties. So now, whenever there's a note holder, a lien holder coming along, he's going to be going after the third guy. So yafta lav sharchov govim in achron. So ein lo govim mishlofanav, ein lo govish mishlofnepanav. And then you just simply follow the order. If, let's say, the last guy doesn't satisfy the total loan, so then you go after the second. If the second guy doesn't satisfy the total loan, then you go after the first. Simple. Now, that is the end of the Braisa. Now, the Gemara is going to insert an assumption. And you know how this always works. You insert an assumption, you realize it's an assumption going in. And when we come out later on, I happen to know, that we're going to adjust the assumption. But let's just right now work with the following assumption. So, and even though the first one is a Beinonis, and the last one is a Ziboris, Miziboris got me Beinonis lo gabe. Still, when the lien holder is coming, he can only come and collect from the Ziboris, and he won't be coming to collect from the Beinonis. And even though, Shma mina b'matana nami avarabana takanta, all this was simply a gift. And even in the case of a gift, we're looking to protect the recipient of the land. The first recipient and the second recipient can ward off the lien holder by simply saying, hey, don't come after us. There's a third guy who was the last one actually receiving the land. So that is the last freestanding property. Free and clear property, you go after that, you don't come after me. And even though number one and number two receive Beinonis, and number three receive Ziboris, again, that's an assumption, but right now let's assume it, still, the first and second guy says, hey, keep going, walk right past us. You'll go to the third recipient, and you only collect from the third recipient, even though the third recipient only has Ziboris. And even though all this was in the context of a gift, not a sale. So you see, based on all that, and there's a lot of assumptions we just made, so you see that the protection of the recipient is not just limited to a lokeach, a purchaser of property, but it's even there to protect the recipient of a gift. So the Gemara deflects. So the Gemara says, well, maybe over here all this was a satisfaction of an obligation. Meaning 1, 2, and 3 were not just the recipients of gift, but they were receiving lands because they were owed lands, meaning they paid for it. The Gemara says, yeah, but the Braisa said the word tenu, and typically the word tenu means it was a gift. So the Gemara says, tenu b'chovi. No, he meant tenu, but meaning give it because it will satisfy my obligation. So the Gemara says, really? So now you're telling me that the first, second, and third people were not just recipients of gifts, but rather they were owed the land. Well, if they were owed the land, why don't they just simply show off the documents that showed who was owed land? Those documents are all going to be dated, and so therefore, why don't we just simply follow the dates of the document? So the Gemara says, Delek Ishtara. The Gemara says, well, maybe there were no documents. So the Gemara says, yeah, but didn't the Braisa use the terminology of Kodem Bishtar? So the Gemara says, no, Shtar Bakarata. The Gemara says, no, Shtar over there did not mean the Shtar of the recipients. It meant the Shtar of the gift giver. Meaning, he wrote it all all up in the shtar. And he said, first give to him, then give to him, then give to him. So right now, what the Gemara's deflection, the first deflection of the Gemara is that these weren't recipients of gifts, they were actually owed the land, and that's why in this case, and only in this case, are we looking to protect them, because they're not just recipients of gifts, they were actually paid for the land. That's deflection number one. Ibai say mafilo matananami. Velokasha, my government achron, a nifsad ela achron. Or the Gemara says no. Maybe really what we could do is the following. We could go back and assume that it was not an obligation, it was rather a gift, like we originally thought. That he, the person who was dying, was gift giving to all three participants. Now what do we say? The Braisa said, Govim and Achron, he collects from the last one. We assume that meant that we're going to collect from the last one because the first and second one say, hey, we're protected. Our properties are protected because when we received our properties, there was still a property left in the hands of the estate. So don't come after us. And we then assume that, that must mean that we're looking to protect even the case of Matana. The Gemara says, no, that's not what it means. Eino nifsad ela acharon. What it means is that ultimately when someone comes and takes the property, they're all going to feel the pinch. Meaning every one of them, we're not really looking to protect one and two. It just simply means that when he takes it away, we're just simply going to redistribute in the order that he prescribed. And probably what's going to end up happening is that, again, what was the order of gift giving? This one first, then that one, and then the third one. If a lien holder comes and takes the property away, so who's going to feel it first? The last guy. Because, okay, fine. The lien holder took away the property. Now what? Now we're going to throw back everything back into the pot, and we're going to redistribute as per the instruction of the deceased. Well, first give to that guy, then give to that guy. Oh, there's nothing left. In other words, the third guy is probably going to feel that the most. That's another pshat in the Braisa. Or the Gemara says another deflection is that maybe our assumption going into the whole discussion was wrong. We assumed that number one got Beinonis. Number two got Beinonis. And what did number three get? Number three got Ziboris. And then based on that assumption, we assumed, that must show us that we're looking to protect the one and two, even though the lien holder is only going to get Ziboris. The Gemara says, maybe not. Maybe 1, 2, and 3 all got Beinonis. Or 1, 2, and 3 all got Ziboris. Meaning the playing field was equal. Under those circumstances, then and only then, is he going to be able to go after number 3. But if 1 got Beinonis, and 2 got Beinonis, and 3 got Ziboris, and we're not talking about Lokeach, we're not talking about purchasers, but we're talking about the recipient of the gift, maybe no. Maybe he would be able to go after number 2, who got Beinonis. So the Gemara says that's another way to deflect this whole proof. So again, question that was presented. Is the institution of the Chachamim to protect the purchasers also going to include the recipient of a gift? So the Gemara brought a Braisa. The Braisa seems to support this basic idea, although the Gemara had three different ways to deflect and say the Braisa doesn't really speak to our question. They were holding the shtar, and they were saying to the Shchimera, okay, you have an outstanding obligation against us, here's our shtar, and he said, I understand, this will be in exchange for the obligation. So the assumption the Gemara was making was, they must be having a shtar against that obligation. And so now if there's a shtar, the shtar is going to be dated. Let's take a look at the dates. That's what the Gemara was. That was the Gemara's assumption. Okay. Eimot yilna achilas peiros. Okay. Let's go back to our Mishnah now. Okay. And the Mishnah went on to discuss that. Let's say the following scenario. Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Okay. We need three people in order to illustrate the following example. So Reuven stole property from Shimon. Okay. Reuven, not a particularly nice individual, so he stole property from Shimon. I know, generally speaking, we say karka ain't an exalus, but okay, in other words, basically, he threw Shimon off the property. Okay. Now, what Reuven did is that Reuven sold the property over to Levi. And Levi did a lot. He put in time, effort, money into the property. He started growing produce on the property. Levi was super excited. Here he is in his new venture. And Shimon says to Levi, look, I'm really sorry, but that property belonged to me. I'm just going to simply take it back. That was my property. Thank you very much. Now, the Mishnah admitted that Levi invested money into the property. So for that, he can actually turn to Shimon and say, look, I bought manure, right? You're gonna pay me for the manure. Okay, so the Mishnah admitted that Shimon's going to pay for any investments that went into the property. But after that point in time now, who's Levi going to turn to? And the answer, obviously, is going to be Reuven. Reuven sold him the property. So that means that Reuven walked away with the money from the sale of that property. And also, on top of that, what about all the produce that was grown that was taken away from Levi? So once again, Levi's going to be able to go back to Reuven. Levi's going to say to Reuven, the produce as well. The Mishnah says on these last two points, the property itself and the payros, so we're going to make the following distinction. The property itself, he can not only can he go after Reuven, but Reuven secured, he guaranteed the sale of that property. So in other words, there was a shtar mecher, there was a title, there was a contract of sale. And so when he goes after Reuven, so he can go after not only Reuven, but any properties that Reuven had. Meaning there's going to be a lien against the properties, all of Reuven's properties, against the sale that he made to Levi. So, Levi can now not only go after Reuven, but go after any of Reuven's properties as well to recoup the loss of the sale. Fine. What about the payros? So the Mishnah says he can only go after Reuven, but he cannot go after any of Reuven's properties for the payros. That's what the Mishnah taught us. Again, just to look at the Mishnah once again. And this was done as a result of Tikkun HaOlam. So what we're going to be doing now is going to try to understand why that should be. Why now can Levi not go after Reuven's properties as it relates to the payros? And why can he only go after Reuven's properties as it relates only to the karka? That's the question. The Gemara is going to give a couple of suggestions. My timer. What is the reason why? Amar Ula Amar Reish Lakish Lefishen Ksuvim. So Reish Lakish's position is, it's not written down. Meaning that when there's a sale of property, and there's a guarantee in that sale of property, meaning I'm selling you the property, and if in the event that this property is taken away from you, from any lien holder that I have, I'm going to make good on that sale, meaning I'm going to make sure that you get back your money. Either personal recourse, you come back to me, and if I have no assets, if I have no money, so then you go after my properties. So that was written down in the contract. The payros, on the other hand, were not written down in the contract. And because the payros were not written down, so therefore there's no lien against the payros. In fact, let's take a look at Rashi together. Lafisha ain ksuvim. Rashi Torah at the bottom of the Amud. Haperos halalu kishenikta v'shtar mechiras hakarka hagzula adayin lo hayu. V'lo kosav b'shtar ela ploni machar karka ploni lifloni. So Rashi says that the only thing that was written down was the actual contract on the property itself. With a guarantee. Hilkach demei hakarka havu kemil v'bishtar. Now, how do we treat the property? It's like any documented note. Where lahachzi achriyas olav, so you have to make a. There, once you have a documented note, that creates a shiba, that creates a lien against all the properties of the. All the properties of the one who obligated himself. But when it comes to the payros, you know what that's like? It's like an undocumented note. And therefore you have no right to collect from any of the properties. Now, Rashi points out that the truth of the matter is if you look at the text of a sale document, now we don't happen to have one readily on hand, but Rashi says, but if you look, it actually says, Ano ekum v'eshpez vina alin, enun. I'm going to guarantee the sale of this land. V'am malehun v'shavchinun uperdidhun. And in the contract of the sale it says, and all the work that you put in, and the fruit also, meaning I'm guaranteeing everything. Ahani la'achav b'achriyasu v'ligbeim imnechareh. Now, even though you wrote that in the contract, so Rashi's going to explain, that's not going to cover the payros, it will only cover the land. Why? Because, one of the most basic rules, why is it that once you have a documented obligation, that creates a lien? So Rashi says, because there's a kol. The assumption going in is that once something is documented, documentation means that you need witnesses signing on it. Witnesses signing on a document means people know about it. So now we can expect the buyer to beware. hey, you know you're going to buy that property. You know there are outstanding loans and obligations against the seller of that property. Just be careful. So there's a fair expectation when somebody buys a property or lends money that the or buys property from somebody who borrowed money or has outstanding loans, that hey, you, this property may be taken away from you. Fine. That's true when it's talking about the actual property itself. Now, on the land itself, one can easily argue that there's a kol on the land itself. Now, you may just as well write the peros into the contract. But that peros that you wrote into the contract is now reflecting what? The peros aren't here yet, meaning the buyer of the property hasn't worked the field, the peros haven't come into fruition. I mean that both literally and figuratively. It's a davar shel bal olam. You're not going to have a kol, says Rashi, on something that is not actually here as of yet. So the kol can only go on the property, the kol cannot go on the fruit. So now, question, why is it that when Levi is trying to get recouped for the sale of the property, good. The sale of the property, he can go after Reuven and can go after Reuven's properties as well. But the sale, but all the fruit that were taken away from him, so he can only go after Reuven, he can't go after Reuven's property. Why? So to put Rashi succinctly, because there's a kol on the property, there is not a kol on the peros. Good. Adkan, that is Reish Lakish's position. It's a function of the peros are not written down. And even if they are, says Rashi, but it's not the kind of writing that produces a kol. So fine. So that is the opinion of Reish Lakish. Back to our Gemara. That is opinion number one. Lefish ein ksuvim. Amale Rabbi Abalu Ula v'hamazon ha'isha v'abonos dekamand ksiv edame v'ktani emotzin. The Gemara says, yeah, but you know what? Support for the wife. Support for the daughters. That is a contractual obligation. Contractual? It's called the ksuva. That is a ksuva obligation, and we've learned throughout Masechet Ksuvos that anything that is considered tonight ksuva is considered part of the ksuva. Support for the wife, support for the daughters, that's tonight ksuva. And ein motzin. And on the other hand, we also say that there, even though the estate has to pay for the support, but there is no lien placed against the properties towards that support. Well, why not? That's part of the ksuva contract. The Gemara says, yeah, but there, that was also part of the contractual agreement. Meaning the ksuva obligation does require the estate to pay for support of the wife and support of the daughters. That's true. But part and parcel of that obligation is that that's only coming from properties that are on hand, but that's not coming from sold off properties. It's just simply part of the ksuva obligation. And not only is this the opinion of Reish Lakish, it's also the opinion of Rav Yochanan as well. Good. So we have agreement between Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan. Why is it that when Levi's trying to recover the sale of the property, that in other words, he purchased the property and it was taken away from him, and the peros as well. So in terms of the property itself, great. He can go after Reuven and go after Reuven's properties. In terms of the peros, he can only go after Reuven. Why? Because it wasn't kasuv b'shtar. It wasn't written in the document. So Amalei Rabbi Zera l'Rav Asi v'hamazon ha'isha v'abanos tekaman deksiv edame v'ktani emotzin. Amalei mikara achi itkun ksuvin hein etzal b'nei chorin v'in ksuvin hein etzal meshubadim. And then the Gemara just goes to the same Q&A with Rav Yochanan that it did with Reish Lakish. What about the support of the daughters and the wife? So the Gemara says part of the ksuva obligation is limited only to the b'nei chorin, not to the meshubadim. Fine. That is all now the first opinion of the Gemara. Why can he not go after the... why can't he go... why isn't there a lien against the peros that were taken away from him? First answer is, it was not written into the document. Second explanation of the Gemara, Rabbi Chinan Amar, Lefish Ein Kitzuvim. Peros is not a fixed amount. You cannot have a lien, an obligation against somebody and against somebody's property on something that is not fixed. If it's something which is a variable, so that cannot create a lien. The lefisha ain't a ketsuvim because it's not a fixed amount. Ibailu the Rabbi Chanina ketsuvim ketsuvim bai odilma ketsuvim va'afa b'shein ketsuvim. So now Gemara wants to pinpoint Rabbi Chanina's position. Is it just a function of being a fixed amount, but it doesn't matter if it was written or not written? Or is the what Rabbi Hanina is saying is no. Actually, you need both. You need it both to be written, and it needs to be a fixed amount in order for there to create a shibud. Now, there is a fascinating Rashi over here on the top of Nun Aleph and Mad Aleph, where Rashi writes, what is essentially the Gemara asking? Gemara is asking, according to Rabbi Hanina, when is there a lien against an obligation? Is it A, when it's fixed, or B, it has to be both fixed and written down? Rashi writes on the top of the Amud, the Isle de Melvapeshi, Kitsuva, Tafim Memeshabde. And essentially, what the Gemara now is proposing, according to Rabbi Hanina, is that maybe even on undocumented loans, you should be able to, there should be a lien against the borrower's properties. Consider, when you have a loan and it's undocumented, it's Ainak Suva, it's not written down, but it's certainly fixed, meaning when I lend money, the borrower and the lender know exactly how much is being lent. So it's a fixed amount, it's katsuv, but it's eno kasuv, but it's not written down. And Rashi is saying that what the Gemara now is proposing is that there should be a lien against even undocumented loans. This comment to Rashi is very difficult. You've been in the daf long enough, you know, it's like one of the basic rules throughout Shas is that there is no lien against undocumented loans. The Gemara right now is proposing this as a pshat within Rabbi Hanina, but it is really hard to maintain. It's difficult to assume that right now the Gemara is even entertaining the idea that there would be a lien against a undocumented loan. But Rashi says it. If you want to see more on this, you can take a look at the first Tosos. Tosos over there quotes the opinion of Rabbi Natam. Rabbi Natam disagrees with his grandfather. Okay, just... I say it all now in a very shorthand manner. Let's go on in the Gemara. Tashma, Di'idmar. The Gemara says, consider the following scenario. This is the Gemara in Ksuvos. We did this Gemara not that long ago. Okay, I take it back. It's been some time. Misha meis v'inich shtei banos. A person died and he left two daughters, Uvein, and a son. V'kadma rishon v'nat leisun achasim. V'lo yispika shnei l'gavos ad shemeis haben. Okay, now some of the basics in terms of Yerusha. If there's a son as part of the children, so he is Yoresh. Even if it's one son and many daughters, the son is Yoresh. There is another discussion about Nechasim Mawatim, but right now let's assume that there's plenty of money left in the estate. The son will inherit. What's going to happen to the daughters? The daughters are going to get what's called Iser Nechasim. Iser Nechasim means that when it's time for the daughter to get married, now just again, I say Bederach Kitzer. There's a really fascinating Rashi over here. Rashi over here writes, the daughter. It's also true when the daughters become mature that they're going to get this tenth of the estate. But if you take a look at Rabbi Kiva Eger, he has such a difficult time with this Rashi. Anyway, let's just say it simply. When the daughters do get married, father died, left an estate, the son inherits the estate. When the daughters get married, they are entitled to get a dowry. Meaning, had the father been alive, the expectation is that the father would have given a dowry over to his daughters in terms of marriage. It's to kickstart the marriage. So the father's no longer here. So there's a general assumption that a tenth of the estate is going to head towards the daughters in terms of the start of their new marriage and life. Now, the Gemara elsewhere asked the question, it's a pretty simple question. If there are 10 daughters, that means that that's a total depletion of the estate. The answer to that question is no. Right, correct. The Gemara has a formula in terms of how to figure out Isur Nechasim. Right now, here's what we're addressing. The situation is where there was one son and two daughters. And the Kadma Rishon of Anat Leisur Nechasim. And the father died. And now they're only left with an estate. The son inherited the estate. First order now is prepared. Now the estate has not yet been...
Nobody got married yet.
Right. Nothing happened yet. First order now gets ready to get married. Okay. She turns to the brother. I'm looking to get married. Fine. Brother now hands her Isur Nechasim. A tenth of the estate over to the daughter as her dowry, as done by the institution Takanas Chachamim, and then v'lo hispika shnei l'gavos ad shemeis haben. And then before the second daughter gets married, what happens? The son dies, and so now what you have over here are an estate and two surviving daughters. So now what happens? The two surviving daughters are now going to be inheriting the estate, because in the absence of sons, the daughters then inherit the estate. But now let's think about it. It's a little bit unfair. Because what happened to the first daughter? First daughter already walked away with the Isur Nesach in the custom. She already walked away with a tenth of the estate. So now, talk about an equitable division of the remainder of the estate. Second daughter says to the first daughter, wait 1 second, slow down. You already got a tenth of the estate because of Isur Nechasim. So it's not an equitable distribution. I'm not getting half of the estate. I'm getting a half of the estate minus the tenth that you already received. So how about this? How about I get my tenth, and then we could talk about an equitable distribution of the remainder of the estate.
Second daughter is not getting married yet.
One second. So Amar Rav Yochanan Shnia Vitra. So Rav Yochanan says, okay. I know I made it sound like it's such a big deal. Rav Yochanan says it's not a big deal. Shnia Vitra, the second daughter is going to be Mevater. Okay, it's a good midah to have in life. To be,
but she doesn't mean married yet.
It's a good midah to have in life. Be mevater. Second daughter is mevater. Okay, you got your Isur Nechasim. Good.
But she's not even getting married yet.
I understand that, but she hopes to get married.
But the thing is that she wants a dowry just in case when she gets married.
Right. The first one got married and she got her tenth, so I should. I plan on getting married, so let's section off a tenth for me, and then we'll distribute the rest of the we'll divide the rest of the estate.
Once she's mature,
Rashi says that and maybe that's one of the reasons why Rashi says it. Either way, Rav Yochanan's position is the second one is mevater. Amalei Rabbi Chanina Gedola Mizu Amram Mosil LaParnasav Mosil LaMezonos VeAtam Arshnia Vitra. So Rabbi Chanina, when he hears his position, Rav Yochanan, Rabbi Chanina goes ballistic. He says it can't possibly be. You can't be right. I don't understand Parnasa. Parnasa over here is the Gemara's terminology for dowry. I can't imagine that the second daughter just simply gives up on the dowry. Did you know, says Rabbi Chanina, that when it comes to the dowry is such a strong obligation. It's such an expectation that the estate is going to give 10% over to the daughter who's going to get married. It's so strong that she has a lien against that dowry. If the estate gets sold to others, the surviving daughters can go over to the purchaser and say, look, I'm really sorry. I know you bought the property from the estate, but you should know that the estate had an obligation to me for my dowry. That obligation is so strong, you can even take it away from Lekuchos. Here, Rabbi Chanina says, no one bought the property. The property's right here. How can you tell me that the second daughter is going to just simply give up on her dowry when meanwhile that obligation is so strong? You can even take it away from people who purchased the estate.
But the thing is, you could argue that the dowry is included in her inheritance. In the 40% that she gets, in whatever she gets,
okay,
the dowry is going to be included. She's not being denied a dowry. She's going to get it later when she gets married, but the thing is included.
Fine.
In the estate.
Okay, you can make that argument. The Gemara, Rabbi Chanina, just, he doesn't want to hear it. So v'ha parnasa to make its kite. So the Gemara says right now, look, in terms of the dowry, it's 10%. So it's a fixed amount. I know it's fixed based on what the total is, but it's fixed in the sense that we know what her percentage is. And it's not written down, so it's fixed but not written. And Rabbi Chanina says, you can go after Lekuchos in order to get it. That seems to be that for Rabbi Chanina, the critical component of the collection from a Lokeach is the fact that it's fixed and it doesn't have to be written down. The Gemara's answer, very simple. Shani Parnasa Kem Diyislei Kala Kem Andiksive Dame. It's tantamount to having been written down. Everybody knows. Every single person knows that a woman, that the daughter of the late father is going to be receiving a dowry, and it's well understood. So when anyone purchased from the estate, it's kikus of dummy. It's as if it's written down. It's totally understood. Okay, so right now we don't have a good. In other words, our question is, according to Rabbi Chanina, is kutsuv the only factor, or is being written down also another consideration? The Gemara right now seems to suggest you need both. Kutsuv v'kutsuv. Gemara continues. Meisav Rav Huna bar Mamnoch. Meisav ben Osam nizonis minechasim. B'nei Chorin, v'hin nizonis minechasim mishubadim, mimnei shehi kebalas chov. Another Gemara that we saw back in Ksuvos, and it discusses the following scenario. A man marries a woman who's been previously married, has daughters from a previous marriage, and she says to her husband, let's do the following. Before we agreed to get married, do me a favor, I'm going to bring a daughter into this marriage, it's going to be your stepdaughter. Can you at least make an obligation You don't have to, but can you make an obligation that you're going to support my daughter for the next 5 years? Okay, now the husband goes in, says, okay, no problem at all. Meaning, he agrees. And then what happens is they get married, and then he divorces her, and then the woman marries a second husband and makes another similar financial arrangement with the second husband. Okay, you're going to support my daughter 5 years, no problem at all. So now she basically has, this stepdaughter now has two stepfathers, right, or two estates, who are now obligated to support her for the next 5 years. So, well, the halacha is, that's what we're learning right now. Mesu b'nevseim nizonis menechas menecharin, v'hi nizonis menechas meshubadim, mimneshi kebalas chov. In terms of the stepdaughter's concern, this was a contracted obligation that was made by both stepfathers. Therefore, it's a contracted obligation, so not only is she entitled to support, but more than that, that support is she's a lien holder against the two estates. If the two estates decide to sell off properties, she can go after the buyers of the properties of that estate. She has such a claim against those two estates. Now, hacha b'maiskinan. I'm sorry. Okay, and where is the Gemara right now? The Gemara right now is assuming that this was just simple a verbal agreement that was made, right? And there was and nothing was written down. And so, how can that be? How can she have a lien against an obligation that was not written down? So, the Gemara says, okay, there was a kinyan that was done over here. An interesting Rashi, again, another Rashi to highlight for today. Rashi says, Bishakana miyado. Rashi is more than halfway down on the page. Vistam kinyan l'ksiva omeid. Once there was a kinyan that was done, so ostensibly it was written down. So basically, this obligation was written down. So ihachi benos nami dave b'shas kinyan. I'm sorry. Ihachi benos nami. So the Gemara says, well, so interesting. The stepdaughters are going to get supported because of the stepfather's commitment that he made. And not only that, but the stepdaughters have a lien against that obligation, so that in the event that the estate sold off properties, the stepdaughter can go after the sold properties as well. The father's own daughters are only going to get supported from the estate. The father's own daughters don't have a lien against that support. So, the Gemara says, that's weird. The stepdaughter is going to get supported, and they have a lien against that support. And the estate's own daughter, the father's own daughter, doesn't have a lien. So the Gemara says, yeah, Bishakana Lazu, Velokana Lazu. So the Gemara says, yeah, because when the stepfather married this girl's mother, he made a contractual obligation. Meaning, I know I'm marrying you, I know you have a daughter, and I'm committing myself, and there was a kinyan, and it was written down, I'm committing myself to support her for the next 5 years. So yes, she's a lien holder against the estate, because he committed himself. So my pascha, so the Gemara says, Bas Yisha Dave Bishas Kinyan, Mahanele Kinyan, Bita Dolahave Bishas Kinyan, La Mahanele Kinyan. So the Gemara says, now, and the distinction is that when it comes to the stepdaughter, so she was there at the chasna. Meaning, right? That's the he married a woman who already had a daughter, so she was there at the chasna. So now he's committing himself to support her, and she's right there. His own daughter, she was not there at the chasna. Kind of hard, nearly impossible. You'll see why I say nearly in just a moment. Nearly impossible for his own daughter to be there at the chasna. So he didn't make that stronger commitment to his very own daughter. So the Gemara says, "Milo askin and dahavit avay b'shas kinyan." So the hechidam edigarsha v'hadra. So the Gemara says, "Look, it's nearly impossible for his own daughter to be at the chasna, but she could be there. Imagine marries a woman, divorces her, and then machzer grushaso. And then 5 years later, after having already had a child with this woman, marries her again. So at least in theory, it's possible that his own daughter could be at the chasna with his mother. She may be blotted out from the from the wedding picture, whatever. But at least it's possible. So in other words, the Gemara is basically saying we have to come up to a more fundamental distinction. Why the stepdaughter not only is going to get supported, but is a lien holder against the estate, and his own daughter is not. So the Gemara says Elabita de Betnai based in Kaachla Lamahanile Kinyan Basi Shadalav Betnai based in Kaachla Mahanile Kinyan. So the Gemara says, look, when we're talking about a man committing himself to support a stepdaughter, that wasn't built into the marriage. That was his own personal obligation that he made. He didn't have to commit himself to that. Truth of the matter is, he didn't have to marry this woman. But he didn't have to commit himself to that, but he did. So for that, now, and he wrote it down. So for that, there's going to be an outstanding obligation that she has against...
It was a verbal commitment. It was a verbal commitment.
I understand, but the Gemara says that there was a kinyan, and Rashi says, and it was then written down. So let's assume, for our purposes, that was written down. So that's why she has not only entitlement to support, but a lien against that support as well. His own daughter, however, so structurally speaking, it was part and parcel of the ksuva. So the Gemara says, I'm not sure if I understand that as well. V'chi migra gara? Wait a second. If it's built into the ksuva, so, right, his own daughter should be any worse than his stepdaughter?
And everybody knows about the ksuva. Correct.
Elabito came into B'nai Beis in Ka'achla, Omer Tzari Atvase. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what the fundamental difference is. The difference is between being an insider versus being an outsider. Meaning, because the stepdaughter is an outsider, there is never any suspicion that, oh, you know, before he died, right, he gave his stepdaughter a little bit of you know, he gave her some cash right before he died. She's an outsider. Meaning, she basically is like any other note holder against the estate. And we're never going to be worried that, hey, here's some money, go buy yourself some dinner. His own daughter, on the other hand, because she's an insider, it's his own daughter, so therefore there is a concern that before he died, he gave her some cash allowance. So therefore, the Gemara says, the outsider, meaning the stepdaughter, is a lien holder against her support, but his very own daughter is not a lien holder against that support.
Okay. She didn't get it.
No?
Why did we suggest before that his own daughter was present at the marriage because it's a daughter of his previous marriage? He's got a book of his previous marriage. We have a problem that the stepdaughter is present at the marriage.
Right.
His daughter isn't right, because we're assuming he's getting a daughter from his new wife.
Right.
Why don't we have a daughter that he had from a previous marriage? And she is present at the second marriage.
Okay, but the Gemara anyway entertained the possibility that he can even have his own daughter. I mean, you're right, and he can even have his own daughter, his own marriage from this woman. Meaning, one doesn't exclude the other, right? The Gemara's point and your point as well, both could be true. All right, let's just finish up over here, and then the hour is late. We gotta move, and then afterwards we'll speak. Tashma Amar Rabbi Nazan Emes Ma'iv Zman Shekadam Mecho Shoshen L'Shivcho Shavishon Ava Kadam Shivcho Shavishon L'Mecho Shosheni Govim Menachas Mishubadim. Okay, and now let's go back to our Mishnah. So again, our Mishnah, how do we structure it? Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Reuven stole land from Shimon. Reuven sold the property to Levi. Levi now, Shimon takes the property away from Levi, rightfully so, because it was Shimon's. Levi now is going to go after Reuven. So what do we say? That in terms of Levi's ability to collect from Reuven for the land itself, it's there's not only a personal obligation for Reuven to pay, but there's a lien against Reuven's properties as well. For the payros, no. Only personal recourse, but nothing on the land itself. So, on that, the Brisa says, Amar Rabbi Nasan Amosai, when is this true? Bizman Shekana Mecho Shoshen L'Shiv Chosha Rishon. That's only when the sale of the second comes before, precedes the shevach of the Rishon. Avakonim shivcho shavishon lamecho shosheni. So, however, if the shevach, if the improvement of land comes before the sale, so then government achas mishubanim. So now, not only can you collect from Reuven, but he can collect from Nechas Meshubadim as well. Amish Misham Delo Kadamu. So the Gemara says, so really, what comes out over here is just a question of order, it's just a question of sequence. And meanwhile, the entire Gemara today, the entire Amud Aleph, was all discussing whether it was written down, whether it was a fixed amount. And here in the Brisa reduces it to a very simple question of what came first. Did the Shevach come first, or did the sale come first? So the Gemara says, Tanaihi. So the Gemara says, on this last point, it's a machlokis Tanaim. Detaim wasn't in Breisa. Emosim lachilas perso, shevach kakos, lamaz and isha, vabanam mechas meshubadim, and may tikana olam. Lefi, shank suvim. So according to the first opinion of the Breisa, it's because it wasn't written down. Am Rav Yossi, vichim ma tikana olam yesh bazu, valo ain kitsuvim. No, it's not because it wasn't written down, it's because it was not a fixed amount. So you see clearly in the Breisa over here that the issue of whether it was written or whether it was affixed, even though originally was presented like a machlokus between Reish Lakish Rav Yochanan versus Rabbi Chanina, the Gemara points out that really the truth of the matter is machlokus amongst the Tanaim. Let's at least start the next sugya. Okay, let's start it. And tomorrow we'll just quickly finish. Shamot Mitzia Lo Yishava. The last Tikkun Olam that we learned together in our Mishnah was returning a lost object. I find your wallet. I come over to you and say, look, I'm a mitzvah boy. Found your wallet. Here's your wallet back. Guy looks at his wallet, opens it up, says, that's very nice of you. I had 250s in there. And now you return it back to me with 150. Small favor. Can you make a shvua that you didn't take that other 50? So the finder will make a shvua, and then we'll make a second shvua, which is, I promise I never will return a lost item again. Okay, so the Mishnah says, I understand that that's the issue. And so the Mishnah says, part another institution that was made, Mitikan Olam, is that the finder is indemnified, and he will not have to make any shvua when he returns a lost item. The Amot Mitzia lo Yishava. Am Rav Yitzchak Shnei Kisim Kshurim Matzas Leva Ala Omer Lo Matzasi Ala Achad Nishba. In the scenario where there were two wallets and they were tied together, and the other one says, "Look, I'm really sorry. I don't know what you're talking about. I found only one wallet. Here it is." So makes a shvua. Shnei Shvarim Kshurim Matzasi Leva Ala Omer Lo Hava Ala Achad Eino Nishba. Now I had two oxen and they were tied together. And the guy says, look, I found one of your ox. So here it is. Lo Yishava. My Tamash Varim, Menatche Mehadade, Kisala Menatche Mehadade. So, and the difference is between being an animate object versus being an inanimate object. An inanimate object, the two wallets, where did the other wallet walk away to? It doesn't. It's strange that you don't have the second wallet over there. It's awfully suspicious. But when it comes to the oxen, a simple, plausible explanation is one of the ox just simply walked away. If, on the other hand, he says the claim and counterclaim went something like this. Hey, my two oxen? The other guy says, yes, correct. I found them, I returned them. So, I'm sorry. So under these circumstances, I'm sorry, I returned one of them. So Harei Zanish, we have to make a shvua. What the Gemara now is going to ask, and we'll start this tomorrow, is I don't understand. Did we just forget everything we learned in the Mishnah? Meaning the Mishnah taught us that you don't have to make a shvua because of Tikkun Olam, because we want people to return lost items, and we want to indemnify them from having to make a shvuah. So why then is the what just happened over here in these cases where a shvuah is in fact necessary when you return part of the lost item? So tomorrow we're gonna explain what's going on over here.